The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio, Freedom 106.5.
So, welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM, Mr. Collier, Charles J.P. Collier. Good morning to you, and welcome. How are you doing?
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'm well. And yourself?
Not too bad. Just hoping that, you know, the weather holds up on the outside, because have you seen the flooding from time to time? That's one of the worst things, being in town and, getting your feet wet. So today we're talking about neurodivergence in schools, neurodiversity in schools.
Yes.
Let's start off with the meaning of the word neurodivergence. What does that mean exactly?
I would go with neurodiversity for a moment, because it's easier to understand that way.
Mm-hmm.
Diversity, of course, means that there's variation, there's variety. And neurodiversity means that there is variety, there's variation, naturally occurring variation in the way that brains are structured, that they work. I'm saying brains, nervous systems overall, but mm-hmm. especially the brain. And it's an important concept, because a lot of the way that we talked about education and intelligence and academic performance in the context of school systems is rooted in medical approaches to things. The biomedical model is a deficit model, meaning that there is assumed to be a norm. The thing that is normal is healthy, it's what's right, it's what's supposed to be, and everything else is regarded as disordered or diseased.
Mm-hmm.
And we've applied that model, which seems perfectly reasonable if you're talking about cancer or an infection or something like that. But we've applied that same model to the way in which people process information, the way that they express themselves, the way that they think. We've applied that medical model to things that are not medical in the same way. They're social. Am I making sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what you end up with is talking about people's differences as disorders, as something being wrong with them. You end up talking about, for example, dyslexia, which is a difference in the way that the brain processes certain kinds of information. We end up talking about it as though it's a disease, a disorder. ADHD, even the names themselves, is referring to it as a disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Attention deficit disorder. Hyperactivity disorder.
Yeah.
And almost every part of that is wrong. It's a name that was formulated at a time when it wasn't that well understood. ADHD is not a disorder, it's not a disease. Autism is not a disease. It's a difference in the way that the brain is organized and the way that the brain processes information. There are obviously times and places and circumstances under which different ways of functioning are better than others, are more effective, more mm-hmm. useful than others. And part of our problem is that we have a school system that doesn't account for that at all.
Mm-hmm.
We have a school system that, very much like the medical model, assumes that there's one right way of processing information, there's one right way of functioning, of being, and everything else is in some way deficient or
abnormal,
less than mm-hmm. in some way. And we in Trinidad and Tobago, we have drunk deeply from that well, because we have established a wealth of ways to tell people that there's something wrong with them intellectually. Mm-hmm. Right? We have, you know, there's this notion that the number of words in within a culture for some particular thing indicates how important that thing is to the culture. And we have a lot of ways to tell people they're stupid. And apparently that's really important to us.
Mm. And the more creative you are with telling someone that they lack intelligence, the you know, the quicker or the better you are. Now, before you do continue, the things that you've described, is it naturally occurring? Does it happen?
Yes, these are naturally occurring variations. Everything in our bodies comes with variations, and we see it all the time. Part of the irony of it is that we in Trinidad and Tobago, we're very, very familiar with diversity.
Mm-hmm.
We're familiar with just how much variation is possible because we are ethnically and culturally one of the most diverse places in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We are accustomed to seeing families where you'll have six children and all six of them look different. All six of them look like they're from some different ethnic background because there is so much ethnic mixing within our nation that different things get expressed in the different children. We're accustomed to that. We're accustomed to the reality that there is so much diversity in terms of the expression of different aspects of our bodies, our hair texture, complexion, shape of our face, height, etc., etc., etc. We're very comfortable with that. We understand that very well, but we don't translate it very well to our brains.
So it has nothing to do with your mother, your grandmother dropping you on your head when you were young, nothing like that?
No, you can have traumatic brain injuries that can cause all sorts of different things.
Right.
But when we're talking about, you know, neurodiversity, for example, in the form of dyslexia or a learning difference with respect to reading or speech or math or some other thing, or you're talking about people with autism or people with ADHD, all of these are naturally occurring. They show up, the different degrees to which their genetic influences, the different degrees to which there can be prenatal kinds of influences. But the bottom line is that all throughout the world, all throughout human history, you find people whose brains are different from the so-called norm, the majority, and different in different ways.
How come we
didn't...
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Now, I was going to ask, how come we're now hearing about this and we didn't hear this years ago? I guess from the example that you're going to give, you could tell us how come they are more open about talking about these abilities. I rather would call them abilities than disabilities. But, you know, how come more attention is being paid now than back then?
So part of it was that we stigmatized people for being different much more. We still do, but we did it more in the past. And my view is that part of that is the legacy of colonialism. Colonialism was not just the fact that Europeans invaded and held land that was not theirs and property that was not theirs and people who were not theirs. Colonialism involved developing a set of systems. Colonialism involved a set of philosophies and beliefs. And in colonial thinking, it's always a zero-sum game, meaning there always is a winner and a loser. There's no such thing as just having differences. There's no everybody wins version of colonialism. There always has to be someone who is put down or harmed in the process.
The oppressor and the oppressed.
Always.
Yeah.
Always. Right? There always has to be a more than and a less than, who has power and who does not, and so on. That's part of the colonial mindset. And that's expressed in a number of ways. And it's particularly expressed in colonial systems. The point of a system is that it maintains whatever is desired by the author of the system beyond that author's direct influence. So if you put in place a system that regards people as in a hierarchy of value, of worth, and you do not remove that system, then you continue beyond the time of the author of that system, the creator of that system. When they are gone, you still have a system in which people are viewed down this hierarchy of value. They're either more than or less than. And so that system has applied in our schooling from colonial times and hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
We're still looking at children being streamed. We're still looking at what I refer to as the Hunger Games to get into a school that offers even a reasonable modicum of education, and we call them prestige schools. They're not really prestige schools. It's schools that have what every child should have.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's trying to get into them because everybody understands that the other schools don't have those fundamental things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as long as we're maintaining those systems, it follows that we maintain the ways in which we treat the students who enter those schools.
Now, the next question...
Treat them hierarchically. Go ahead.
No, it's pertaining to the observation that you just made, moving from colonialism and the hierarchy of the schools, who can and who can't. Should neurodivergent children be in schools with others?
They should. And part of the reason they should is because neurodivergent people are in every other part of our society. There are lots of neurodivergent people all across our society. People just don't recognize that they're neurodivergent. I know for a fact of a number of people who hold high office who have autism. I know of a number of people who hold a high office who have ADHD. There are people who hold high office who have dyslexia. Those are things that happen across the board. And part of what is striking is it means that it is possible for people to have differences and be perfectly functional, capable members of society.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have systems that actually foster that, that encourage that. One of the more shocking experiences for me was having discussion with people in a so-called prestige school about making accommodations for a child who was neurodivergent. Mm-hmm. And having very little success getting the school to move, because the school acknowledged that the Ministry of Education does not provide the appropriate tools and systemic support to do that in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And at the level of the school, the teachers themselves are concerned about making accommodations because it's not well understood, and their concern is that other students for whom accommodations are not made are likely to feel slighted or robbed of something in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And so the focus is on maintaining the appearance of equality, but it's not equality. I'll give you an example of neurodiversity that is not accommodated and for which there's systemic disregard. Left-handedness is a form of neurodiversity. The brains of people who are left-handed differ from those who are right-handed. Left-handed people's brains are less... our brains, the hemispheres of our brains are largely divided, and they operate differently. that's less true for left-handed people. Left-handed people's brains communicate across the hemispheres much more, and they share functions across the hemispheres much more than right-handed people's brains do. And so we're talking about a brain difference that is involved with left-handedness. But if you back up 50 years, people were still in schools eating children for using their left hand.
What if, also, if it is that you are ambidextrous?
And ambidexterity, true ambidexterity, is even less common than left-handedness. What is more common is mixed dominance, meaning that you use the right for some things and the left for other things. True ambidexterity means that you are completely able to use either hand, either side, to do things on either side with equal fluency and capacity. And that only occurs in about 1% of the population. But mixed handedness is also about 10% of the population. And so about 80% of the population is right-handed, functionally, completely right-handed. And 20% is not. But when, you know, if you have friends who are left-handed, if you're not left-handed yourself, the nightmare of writing in cursive on an essay where you are, as a matter of system, writing from left to right, is, that's, you know, I used to make a joke about it when we were children, but when I think about it now, it's like ridiculous.
And the, that you have, and that at that age and stage, children aren't encouraged to speak up as, well, this is not working for me, because they wouldn't be able to articulate that just yet.
Right.
And the
and the message you get is that something is wrong with you,
and you are standing up to authority, and you need to be punished. When you're just trying to express, well, look, you. Trying
this
to figure this
how my brain works.
Yeah. Now, the reason why the question, should neurodivergent children be in school with others, you say yes. However, I'm thinking as well, you are acknowledging that some attention needs to be paid to how the systems work to encourage children to feel safe enough to learn.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The system has to shift in order for everyone to have access, for everyone to have appropriate opportunities. And again, there are things that we do that account for this and accommodate it, and there are things where we don't. Or a simple example, right? There are differences in vision. We don't for a moment suggest to children who have differences in vision that make it difficult for them to read text as it is written in a standard textbook. We don't punish them for that. We make accommodations for it. We try to ensure that they get appropriate care in terms of getting glasses, getting tested, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so that they can make these literal physical accommodations that they carry around on their faces all the time, so that they too can read what the other students are reading. It's an accommodation that is made. It is the use of a form of assistive technology. Glasses are one of the most common forms of assistive technology. But we don't generally think of it that way. When it comes to, for example, assistive technology for a child with ADHD who is likely to have great difficulty taking notes and paying attention to what is being said at the same time. Because one of the patterns of ADHD is a tendency to hyperfocus on one thing and have everything else sort of disappear from attention. And so trying to pay attention to what is being said and simultaneously pay attention to what is being written, to divide attention in that way, is very difficult for people with ADHD. Simple assistive approach would be to allow recording of, you know, what it was being said by which of verbal instruction, teaching, etc. Either allow recording that way and allow the child to focus on writing notes, or provide a written summary to everybody, and allow the child to listen freely during the class and not have the demand to do something that their brain doesn't do well, and that ends up serving as a barrier, and ends up being confused with the child's actual intelligence. It's not, or the child's capacity to learn. It's not about the child's capacity to learn. It's how the child learns.
Is medication needed in circumstances like this?
Medication is an iffy thing for us in Trinidad and Tobago. We're really, culturally, we're very reluctant to take medications, particularly for anything to do with the mind. I think that it follows from a couple of things. A lot of the stigma that we have about mental health in general, and I think it also follows from the fear of addiction. And so even when we're talking about things that are not, in fact, habit-forming substances, people are often very concerned that someone would become addicted to them if they use it. There's also a fear of just being dependent on it, which I think comes back to the stigma. The idea that I can only do this if I take this this medication means that something is wrong with me. Well, no, it means that there's something different, and that to perform this particular kind of task, there's something different that you need to do. Medication is not always required for ADHD, for example. Some instances it's advisable. It helps, but it doesn't address everything that needs to be addressed. And medication should be accompanied by appropriate coaching, training, use of assistive technology, modification of systems. All of those things should be in play. Medication by itself should not be the only thing that is applied.
Now, what can teachers do? You're making a lot of sense. It's an eye-opening conversation, and I'm wondering how many educators would have liked to be part of this conversation as well, so that, you know, as the new government comes in, we could have some sort of discussion in terms of education, because there is a huge gap of children who may be acting out because they have these capabilities but aren't sure how to navigate through them, and their teachers are just as frustrated, and you know, say, you know what, I'm not studying you because I have got 30 something other children to attend to. So let's
and
talk
that
about
that. Is very much a system issue.
Yeah,
that right there is one of the biggest systemic issues. And I do appreciate the challenge that teachers face, and my whole family is full of educators. I know full well just how much work is involved. But if you do have a system in which you have resources only to teach children who are neurotypical, and there are no additional measures or accommodations or systems or technology in place, you set the stage for a teacher to have to make a decision about that. And so the reason that I'm talking about the systems in this way is that this is not a problem that can be adequately addressed without addressing the systems.
And without willing to change the systems as well, to challenge them.
Well, you know, challenging the system means, first of all, telling the simple truth of what's happening. That doesn't guarantee that things are going to be changed forthwith, but it is an important step in the process.
Well, with that in mind, are there like one or two tips or three tips you can give to teachers within their remit that stands now that can assist them in assisting those students that they may, by either by observation or diagnosis can help children with these mental abilities?
Yeah, one of the things is education of teachers about these things. I don't mean that teachers have to all go back to school and so on, but rather that it would be valuable to have a systemic process of providing fundamental information to teachers about what these things are in the first place, what they mean, what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have a frame of a lot of neurodiversity. A lot of it is framed for us culturally as the children being lazy or stupid or worthless or hard head or bad mind or any number of negative things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to have teachers discover that none of that is actually true. Actual laziness is very, very unusual. Almost always when children are not performing to the degree or to the extent or to the caliber that teachers are seeking, there's something else that's happening. And that one shift, the notion that there's a reason for this, it's not something negative, there's something else that this child needs, that shift is one of the most important things that a teacher can do. To simply take the position that this child's different behavior or different response or different academic functioning simply means that there's something else that they need that is different from what they're getting at the moment. It doesn't mean that they're bad. It doesn't mean that they're lazy. It doesn't mean that they're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
That's one. Two, as odd as it sounds, related to that is that kindness and a willingness to listen will go further than almost anything else. If we're willing to listen, children will tell us a lot of what we need to know in order to benefit them in almost any area of their lives. Establishing a relationship of listening to children rather than woofing them and shutting them down and silencing them. I don't mean you should just allow complete chaos all the time, but there should be a point of listening. One of the interesting things that happens is if you set aside a specific period of time where children can ask questions or make comments anonymously in the class and have them be taken seriously and answered, it changes the dynamics of the class. And it becomes possible to address things in a healthy way rather than having things become a power struggle and so on in the classroom. I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. Let's hope that it helps some teachers who are aware of their children and would like to help in that way. We've got 5 minutes to news here. Mr. Collier, thank you so much for joining us today. Oh, is it doctor?
It's Mr.
Mr. All right. I'm just making sure because, you know, respect is due. So thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Collier, today. And next week, we could probably get some more into neurodivergence and what it really means in today's school education system.
Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.